The dangers of climate change, they're real, and they're already affecting our environment. One nationally known author says, now is the time to make needed changes. There is not a moment to lose. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live at 9. Also, make sure to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Just ahead, author Jeff Nesbitt on his new book, looking at the peril of climate change. It's called This is the Way the World Ends. Not to alarm you, but it is alarming, and we're going to talk about it. We want your calls right now, 549-2937. Then later, solutions to our warming planet. It's our Going Green on the show today, how you can incorporate sustainable ideas into your own yard. Plus, this year's transformation celebration at the Sulzbacher Center, as the Center for this area's homeless celebrates 20 years on the First Coast. All of that and more ahead this morning. But first this hour, it's an alarming explanation of the climate challenge we face here in Florida and around the world. Climate change is not a far-off threat. It's impacting us right now. At this very moment, communities around the world are feeling its impacts, and we ignore the science around climate change at our own peril. Everything from longer droughts overseas to Category 6, yes, Category 6 hurricanes here in Florida, and more, are in our future if we don't act now to stave off the worst impacts of climate change. That's the message from Jeff Nesbitt. He's executive director of Climate Nexus and author of the new book, This is the Way the World Ends, How Droughts, Die-Offs, Heat Waves, and Hurricanes Are Converging on America. Jeff is on the line with more. Jeff Nesbitt, good to have you on the show. Good morning.
Thanks, Melissa, for having me.
And from Category 6 hurricanes to drought, food shortages, and more, it truly is a parade of horribles when you look at the worst projected impacts of climate change if we do not act. What are your questions and comments for author Jeff Nesbitt? It's 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails about this to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And we're already getting your comments on our Facebook page. All right. So, Jeff, in addition to being an author, you've also served as director of public affairs for two federal science agencies. And in this book, you try to get past the politics around people not being on the same page about climate change and really looking at the reality of this and the solutions, everything from what we're seeing now around the world, from bleaching coral reefs to melting glaciers to water shortages in cities to potentially Category 6 hurricanes right here in Florida. This is a very serious and important book. Let's begin with the first section of the book, which you call The Truth, looking at the changes in our natural environment. Lay out the picture for us around the world when you look at the situation around climate change right now.
Sure, thanks. And actually, that word projected, I wanted to pick up on that because that's one of the principal reasons why I wrote this book. I've been dealing with this issue for a long time, starting from my days at the National Science Foundation, where I worked during the second Bush administration, a Republican administration. There are serious climate impacts happening right now. They're no longer projected off into the later parts of this century. Yemen, for instance, is effectively out of water. Saudi Arabia, effectively out of water. Even northern China is really struggling with water scarcity issues that are forcing them to go all around the world to search for natural resources. Food insecurity problems, basically what food insecurity means is that people don't have enough food. They can't grow enough food in their country, so they have to import it. Half of the population on Earth now has to import their food because there isn't enough water or resources to grow that food. And climate change is effectively the 800-pound gorilla that sits over the top of all of this. There are other reasons for some of these problems, but climate change is either making it worse or much worse in some cases and causing harm right now. In the United States, we're very lucky that we live in a temperate zone because that means that we're escaping some of these impacts occurring right now, but we won't be for very much longer. And people in Florida are seeing this right now. I mean, one of the aspects of the book that I think has really surprised people is that we may very well start to see what would be called Category 6 storms if we had a Category 6, because the storms are much more intense. Hurricanes and tropical cyclones are much more intense over much warmer ocean waters and are hitting speeds that we wouldn't have thought we would have seen before. If they spin up that fast and were to, say, hit a city like Tampa Bay, it could do serious damage to a city like Tampa Bay. Jacksonville's, would obviously be at risk in that regard. So are any of the cities around the coastline of Florida.
Right. And in addition to Category 6 hurricanes, in this book, This Is the Way the World Ends, you make some other predictions for what climate change could present in the future. What are some of those predictions, and what is your timetable for these impacts?
So they are predictions, but again, this is the point of this book. People, for whatever reason, people have assumed that the worst impacts of climate change wouldn't start to occur until later this century. And while that's true in some cases, like sea level rise, there are very severe impacts starting to occur right now, and those are harbingers for things that we're going to see in the near-term future. A good example is we now know that hundreds of glaciers have melted in the Himalayas, smaller glaciers, for sure. But that means that the water that comes down from the tops of those mountains that is the essential fresh water for lots of folks in the hinterlands, they're at risk right now. We are already starting to see the monsoon season potentially become unstable in India. That's a chapter. It's a pretty controversial chapter, but it's based on the latest scientific research that if the monsoon were to become unstable, more than 1 billion people would be at risk of not being able to have water in that part of the country. So those types of things combined with the serious multi-year droughts that we're seeing in sub-Saharan Africa, the problem with the spreading desert in the Sahel that touches 13 countries and is at the core of the migration and forcing people away from their farms and are fleeing to Europe. Those things are happening right now. They're not happening in the United States just yet, but they're happening right now, and it's only a matter of time before some of those things start to reach the United States.
Okay, and how do you see the potential coming together of not just only this country but the world to take action around this? In your book, you lay out a blueprint for addressing our climate crisis. It's difficult politically, particularly here in the United States, where, a third to 45% of Americans still have not accepted the science around climate change or don't think it's as serious as climate scientists and authors like you believed it to be.
You're exactly right about that, but I want to make a couple of points. First, for me personally, I worked in two Republican presidential administrations. I ran the public affairs offices at the FDA and the National Science Foundation in two Republican administrations. I also worked at the White House. I was former Vice President Dan Quayle's communications director. I worked in two Republican presidential campaigns. There was a time once when Republican leaders were more than happy and more than willing to talk about this and to try to deal with it. That's not really the case today for a variety of reasons, but I do think times are changing. And one of the things that's changing is nearly all of the big companies, the Fortune 100 companies, and including all of the oil and gas majors, now recognize this. There are significant climate risks present in our world today, and they want to do something about it. For instance, the We Are Still In coalition that occurred after President Trump withdrew from Paris, we have almost 4,000 signatures, CEOs and businesses, half of the Fortune 100, is actually doing something. And I wanted to give a shout out to what you guys are doing on air today. Your Project Green, that's actually a solution that people are recognizing. Mm-hmm. Science is showing that if you have if you plant trees in your backyard, and it can collectively add up to a very significant carbon sink and help the problem. So I think people and companies and others are doing things. It hasn't gotten to the Republican elected leadership in Washington yet, but I think it will soon.
And what are other things, five simple things you say everyone in this country can do to address this issue?
So the first is, just talk to your friends and neighbors. I know this sounds silly, but that's actually important. We need to lower the temperature, so to speak, in our dialogue about this issue. And so I would encourage people not to view this as a partisan issue or a political issue. I know that's hard, but that's the first thing. The second thing is if you care about it, go vote. I'll tell you, our organization is conducting a poll in Florida, specifically parts of Jacksonville. And what you see is when people recognize that this issue is affecting them locally, you look out your window and see more extreme weather. You see
historic flooding. We experienced flooding, that last year. What did your polling show in Jacksonville?
It showed that when you ask somebody, is this an issue you care about? Well, you go to the polls and vote for it. At the start of that discussion, it's way down on the totem pole like it always is. But when you then start to ask a voter, a registered or likely voter, you know, if they were aware of the historic flooding, if they're aware of the rising sea levels causing, you know, intrusion in marshes, or if you're aware of the devastation of the local economy when a hurricane hits, heat waves that cause real trouble for extended periods of time, and then you combine that with, wouldn't you love to see the Sunshine State become the solar revolution center of the universe? The issue goes way up the charts, like as the number one or two issue to voters. We saw that in Jacksonville and other parts of the state. So what that tells us is we need to get local about this. We need to understand that these things are happening now and locally. They could potentially pose a grave risk if we don't address it, and that we need to get to the cleaner energy revolution as fast as we possibly can. And Florida's sort of ground zero for both of those.
All right. It sure is. And what are your other tips for people who care about this issue?
The other thing is what you guys are talking about. I know this sounds a little bit out there, but truthfully, natural carbon sink solution, natural solutions, which is planting trees and at a bigger scale, making sure that forests aren't cut down. But planting trees is actually a big deal. And if enough people were to plant trees, and that will help, because trees actually serve as a carbon sink. So greening your garden is helpful. Thinking about your energy bills and looking at potentially ways and talking to your neighbors and others about switching to, or even paying for carbon offsets, that matters. And if you can, sure, buy an electric vehicle, get involved in the electric vehicle revolution, because within 10 to 15 years, the internal combustion engine may be done for good. So those are some of the things that you can do. But the most important thing is just talk. Talk about this issue. Don't just be afraid of it. Talk about it, because we can solve this.
And we talk about it on this show as often as we can. So it's good to have author Jeff Nesbitt on today. His book is called This Is the Way the World Ends. I know that sounds apocalyptic, but it's a realistic look at the real costs posed by climate change and solutions. What are your thoughts, questions, comments? Call us right now, 549-2937. Scott is in Orange Park. Hi, Scott. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. How are you?
All right, thanks. Go ahead.
These are things that we've known about for years. In 1972, there was Club of Rome had MIT supercomputers run scenarios. And the scenario that they came up with four scenarios: best case, worst case, World War III, and business as usual. And we're following the business as usual model, where resources dwindle, easily available resources dwindle. We're going to have agricultural output just about plummet. We hit about 9 billion people, according to these graphs, which have been dead on. And we basically go through a collapse. It's called population overshoot. And we're in, there's a scenario called carrying capacity. What is the carrying capacity of an ecosystem? We've exceeded ours. So it's going to be a horrific change that the world is going to face. And that's about the only way I think humanity ever changes. We talk about doing things like going green. Reagan infamously took down the solar panels from the roof of the White House. We were ahead of the game in wind technology and solar technology. And in the 80s, Vestas bought up all our wind patents. Sony bought up all our solar patents. So what you're talking about in climate change, you have to realize that what was facing the world is where normally, because the Earth's normal is an ice age.
Mm-hmm. I get your point,
instead
Scott. I take your point. And let me get Jeff to react. I'm going to get Jeff Nesbitt to react to what you're saying. Thanks for the call, Scott.
Well,
okay. Thanks for the call.
Him,
yeah, go ahead quickly.
my question for him is, you know, our normal for our reset would be 300 parts per million of carbon dioxide. We're now over 400 and still climbing. This is what in the world you think could ever reverse that? And
okay.
Is it too late?
Thank you, Scott. Thanks for the call. Okay, Jeff Nisbet, as you write in your book, within about two decades, you write that our carbon budget will reach a point of no return, and then there will be a series of unstoppable catastrophes, a parade of horribles, which, and I think what the caller was getting at was, we've known this for a while, and we have not moved aggressively enough. And is the tip? Are we at a tipping point where it's too late? I think that's the fear of a lot of people that monitor this science closely. About that?
So I don't believe we're at a tipping point yet. At least I hope not. But Scott's exactly right about the major points that he was making, and it's one of the reasons, again, why I wrote this book. I think it's important that people recognize we are seeing signals of very serious climate impacts starting to occur across the world right now, not 50 years from now, but right now. Whether all those collectively add up, whether the rapidly warming temperatures melts ice sheets in Greenland or Antarctica or elsewhere, time will tell. But we are seeing serious impacts right now. Will they add up to tipping points in the near future? Scientists are studying that pretty closely. The carbon budget means, because once carbon's in the atmosphere, it lasts for hundreds of years. So we exhaust that carbon budget within 15 to 20 years. That's basically the time frame we have to get this right and start to reverse this problem. At least we need to slow down first, ultimately get to what's called net zero, sort of zero emissions from carbon on balance, to try to keep some of these worst impacts from happening. I believe we have time. I think it's going to take collective action, but I think Scott's also right that it's going to take a recognition that we're seeing mass migrations, water scarcity issues all across the world, not necessarily in the United States yet, before people may wake up and say, oh my gosh, we're running out of natural resources. We can't, and when you don't have water in a country, really bad things happen. Yemen's a good example of that. That's one of the chapters in the book.
Yeah. I think of the famous quote from Winston Churchill that Americans always do the right thing, but only after they've exhausted all other options. And it seems as though on this issue, that's how America is responding. Until it's in your face here in America, and until you've got water coming into your house regularly, or there's no water coming out of the tap, or it's so hot that you are not able to live somewhere anymore, until you are physically confronted with the realities of this, for many Americans, it's not real. And so how do you get past that? Here's an email from Kathy. She emails the show. We need figures about the serious economic impacts of climate change. Just the cost to Jacksonville has been huge since the storm last year. She's referring to Hurricane Irma and the historic flooding we experienced. She says it seems to be the only argument that often has a real impact. Dollars and cents. Jeff.
So I'll tell you, one of the things, I've talked to a lot of the insurance companies. They won't say this publicly, but the truth is there may be significant parts of the American coastline that are uninsurable now because of the threat from flooding, extreme weather events like hurricanes, and sea level rise with saltwater intrusion.
And how is that going to affect Florida? Think about the effect on Florida.
The effect on Florida could potentially be huge. In South Florida, you're already starting to see what's called gentrification. The smarter developers are going inland to buy land that's higher up, and they're basically taking that land from the poor, from the poor, and that's what gentrification is. And some, they're paying for it, but they're not, to avoid that problem. If homes are uninsurable along the coastline in places, then there are no options. Then people may have homes that they won't be able to sell, so they'll be stuck there. That's a real economic impact. It's quite local, and when that starts to happen across the board, I think that's the sort of a wake-up call.
So you see, when the insurance companies start circling the drain in coastal areas, that is going to, that the rubber will really hit the road then.
It really will hit the road.
But the question is when? Nobody has an answer to that.
Well, my answer is that it's starting to happen now. They just haven't started to talk about it publicly. The FEMA flood insurance program is essentially bankrupt. There isn't money to cover those costs. So every time you see something hit, Houston's a good example. That hurricane hit, probably 10% of the people who had their homes had flood insurance coverage. They're out of luck now at this point. They don't know, you know. So without insurance, an extreme event hits with the climate, you know, having exacerbated that. Everybody says, oh, my gosh, what do we do now? Why did this happen? At that point in a local community, it you know, they're simply trying to recover just as they were in Puerto Rico. I mean, it took Puerto Rico an entire year to turn the power back on. So some of these things are happening right now, and I think they're wake-up calls right now. In other parts of the world, again, other sub-Saharan Africa, I mean, there's a country where there is no food. They're literally boiling cactus to try to feed the people, which has no nutritional value. So we're lucky in the United States we haven't seen these, but it's not too far away. I mean, the same aquifers that run beneath Saudi Arabia, the same type of aquifer runs beneath the Central Valley in California. And if that aquifer should get drained, or the Colorado River Basin should hit historically low levels, which they might in the next 2 to 3 years, that's going to raise some big questions for people about water scarcity in the American West.
Let's take some more calls for author Jeff Nesbitt. It's the book called This is the Way the World Ends, Looking at the Climate Crisis, 549-2937. Andy is in Arlington. Hi, Andy. Good morning. Go ahead.
Good morning. Excellent show. I promise I'll buy the book and I'll read the book and I'll study the book. But gee whiz, I think that our author is shooting himself in the foot. I think he's hurting his cause more than the people who are directly trying to hurt the cause. To tell us this is not a partisan issue makes no sense. 99% of the people in the entire world who are science deniers are members of the Republican Party in the United States. Here in Florida, it's illegal to talk about climate change if you are a state employee. The governor for the last 8 years has made it illegal to do so. You'll get fired if you do. We have
not illegal, but not right. Recommended if you're that type of employee.
I don't know how it could be more illegal than to just say that if you talk about climate change, we will fire you. That's pretty much illegal to me.
Yeah.
Okay, and that's a former talk show host Andy Johnson on the phone. Hey, Andy, I get your point. We're running up against a break, but let me get Jeff to react to what you're saying, because we're getting Facebook comments about that too, Jeff. Here's one from Jim. Voting for people who believe in science would be a good start. So what about Andy's question to you, that you're saying it's not partisan, but the political reality is it is. Thanks,
yeah,
Andy, for the call.
Let me be clear. Andy's right, and I'm not saying it's not partisan. It is clearly partisan. There's no question. This is a part. You know, Democrats believe the science, and you know, most of the Republican Party doesn't. What I'm saying is, it needs to not be partisan. That's what I'm saying. As soon as we possibly can, we need to convince some segment of the Republican Party to take this issue seriously. That's what I'm saying. It is clearly a partisan issue right now. There is no question. It's every bit as partisan as abortion or gun violence or immigration. Climate's in that pantheon of partisan issues. So Andy is completely correct about that. I want to be clear. I'm not saying that it's not partisan. What I am saying is, we need a national climate solution in the United States. We need a law. And to do that, we need some segment of the Republican Party to get real about this issue, take it seriously, and want to solve it. Let me be as clear as I possibly can about that.
Ellen is in Julington Creek. Go ahead, Ellen.
Hi, Melissa. Thank you for taking my call. My big issue that I focus on, because it's something I can do, is plastic bags and plastic in general. And when I go to a grocery store and all of them do it, and I see people walking out with piles of plastic bags, sometimes just holding one thing, it makes me crazy. I use cloth bags. I give cloth bags to people for gifts, you know, and I buy these bracelets that the Four Ocean program is selling to support the cleaning of the ocean. How significant is that, and how hard is it to get grocery stores to stop using all those millions of plastic bags?
Yeah, thanks, Ellen. And, you know, some states have actually banned them. But she's right. That's a small action people can take when they go grocery shopping, Jeff.
It is, actually. And it's turning into one of those things that lots of people are hearing about. The movement to not have plastic straws in restaurants is another example where, you know, people want to do something. Because so much oil, you know, plastic is oil-based, so you've got a fossil fuel that's an important part of the process, the processing. She's exactly right. That's a small thing, but it adds up. If we were to collectively say we want an alternative to plastic, that can make a difference. I don't want to say that we should be banning plastic everywhere, but the concept is certainly there, that if you reduce the use, the necessary use of fossil fuels in processed products, it will absolutely make a difference if it all adds up collectively.
And what would you say to more conservative listeners would probably say, well, I don't want to be told to do that.
Correct.
I want to make the choice. I want to be, people might like an encouragement or an incentive to do it, but they don't necessarily want it to be mandated. So what about that?
So I'm quite sympathetic to that. One of the chapters in the book where I talk about, it's called The Anvil, where I talk about, you know, you can have a command and control structure where you tell people what to do, or you can have a market structure. I think it's possible that a big market-based solution like a significant carbon tax, which I support, can absolutely work. We need to fundamentally change the energy system. I'd like for consumers to make their choices, and, you know, that help. I fully support that. I also think that we're at a point where we need to, it's sort of all hands on deck. We need to look at all options to reduce carbon emissions, and we have about 15 years to do it. So I think we should put everything on the table and see what works, both collectively among consumers and people, but also among businesses and ultimately among government leaders who have to look at these national solutions.
Let's go to Gregory quickly on the South Side. Hi, Gregory. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. I just had a couple of quick questions. So I work in domestic water treatment, and over the last few months, I've seen a major influx in Jacksonville in people's wells, especially shallow wells, drying up and pumping sand. I know the water tables shift naturally, but I'm just wondering, and even a couple of deep artesian wells I've seen have dried up, and I'm wondering how much effect the climate change has had on that, or the hurricane flooding on the coastlines, and what kind of effect that may have on these water tables shifting, because I'm dealing with 3 to 5 of them a week, especially in the north sides and outskirts of Jacksonville. And it's been a major influx of it, where I went from dealing with 1 every 4 to 5 months to about 3 to 5 a week right now.
Yeah, thanks, Gregory.
That's a really interesting question. And there are people who are working in fields just like he is are asking exactly that question. Saltwater intrusion and flooding from extreme weather events they're unpredictable events. The sad truth is we don't have a whole lot of research on marshlands and wetlands and saltwater intrusion, sort of the ebb and the flow. We need a lot more of that research pretty quickly. It's one of the areas that people are taking a pretty close look at because it's been under-researched to this point. The question he's raising is a really important one. We need to know the answer to that question. We don't exactly yet. But we are seeing, I mean, as an example in South Florida, Miami, all the police cars have to rust coat, rust-proof the cars because they're seeing saltwater intrusion, come into, you know, there's even daytime flooding on a regular basis. That never happened before. And so the intrusion in the wetlands, the type of stuff he's talking about that gets into the water flows and causes trouble, people are taking a really close look at that now, and they never really used to all that much, but we need to.
Mary on the South Side. Go ahead, Mary.
Hello. I was just calling in about the headlines this morning about the plan to continue with the dredging of our river, and I wondered if there might be any hope to backtrack on that plan based on what we know that happened at Irma.
Sure. You know, and I don't know how familiar you are with this, Jeff, but plans to dredge the St. John's River in Jacksonville down to a depth of 47 feet to accommodate larger cargo ships that the Jacksport wants to attract through the widened Panama Canal. That is going forward despite concerns from environmental groups and also a lawsuit looking at the potential impacts, particularly if higher storm surges and more historic flooding could impact this city, which has a lot of neighborhoods that hug the St. John's River. So the argument in Jacksonville has been around the job creation and the economic benefits that would come from the dredging project. Critics have said there will be environmental impacts and that the investment is not going to generate the number of jobs predicted. So that's the argument on that one.
Well, there's I hope everybody's taking a look at risk reward there. As you can see in North Carolina, I mean, there have been a couple of these hurricanes that have hit the American coastline. In one instance, you know, a river literally reversed course and went back upstream. I mean, instead of flowing out into the ocean, you see the historic flooding. I mean, two interstates in North Carolina were underwater. So you need to take a really careful, if you're along the coastline as Jacksonville is, you need to take a really careful look at what might happen when you get historic flooding, because hurricanes are going to continue to hit Jacksonville. There's going to be a lot more water in them. The one that just hit Maria had the science attribution studies are showing 50% more water in that storm because of climate change, and it was a much bigger storm because of climate change. So you have to anticipate that. So more water, you better take a look at your waterway and see what it's going to look like if something potentially catastrophic happens, or is it going to flood all the neighborhoods, and what happens then?
Lane tweets the show, I'm a Republican voter, but I expect my leaders to act on climate change. I'm considering voting for Andrew Gillum because of his stance on the environment. The environmental issue here in Florida is nuanced, given that our environment is our economy. So that's why we tend to focus on this quite a bit on the show. So author Jeff Nesbitt, author of This is the Way the World Ends, executive director of Climate Nexus, thank you so much for being with us and sharing your insights with our listeners. We appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. Those were really thoughtful questions. It was a great discussion. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Much more still ahead later, celebrating 20 years of the Sulzbacher Center in Jacksonville, transforming lives for the homeless. But up next, how to protect your own slice of the environment, as we just talked about, by getting native plants in your backyard. That's in our Going Green after this.
We know you understand how important it is for everyone in our community to have access to thoughtful conversation, trusted information, and real news. That's why it's time to give. Help us reach our $60,000 fundraising goal by donating now at wjct.org/radio. And let's not have a pledge drive that interrupts shows. Thank you.
DJ Skelton is the most severely wounded soldier to ever return to combat after a blast in Iraq damaged his leg, arm, eye, and palate.
He had instant credibility with the young men that he was leading at the time. This is leadership by example.
I'm Audie Cornish. Now 14 years after his injuries, Major DJ Skelton has retired. His story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
This Going Green segment is made possible by A1A Solar.
Welcome back. Well, in our first segment this morning, we heard a lot about the perils posed by climate change. Now we're going to talk about simple solutions, sustainable ones, ways everyone can mitigate the dangers that we face from a warming planet. There are simple ways you can cultivate a more sustainable lifestyle, and one that we want to focus on right now is your garden, your backyard. First Coast author and gardener and blogger Ginny Steibel teaches people how to transform their yards into lush, sustainable landscapes filled with authentic Florida plants. She's here now with a little more on that in today's Going Green. Ginny, good to see you.
Thanks for having me.
And it's 549-2937 if you have a question about planting a Florida-friendly yard. Now, your new book is called Climate-Wise Landscaping, Practical Actions for a Sustainable Future. Very cool.
Yes, I have a co-author in Massachusetts, so it's not just for Florida. But of course, Florida's more at risk than a lot of other states, so we certainly did talk about that. But Sue and I did not debate climate change. We said, let's roll up our sleeves and get busy. Let's do something right now.
Sure. And you in this book, and also on your blog, which is greengardeningmatters.com, you teach people, here's what you can do to plant things on your own land that are healthier for the globe, the planet? What are some tips you can give all of us here in Florida right now?
Well, the biggest thing that you can do in your landscape to help the climate is to stop the typical lawn care, where the lawn guys come and they put down fungicides and insecticides and herbicides, and then, because that's not really good for the grass either, then they put synthetic fertilizers, which washes into our waterways, and they overwater it. 30 to 60% of our potable water is put in our landscapes. So if we just let the lawns go, liberate the lawns, or have a freedom lawn so that whatever grows, you mow. And don't worry about the weeds, just mow it and reduce the size and replace some of the lawn with native plants. And mm-hmm. that would give you an authentic Florida yard. Much of Florida looks like Hawaii, or it looks like New England, where people are trying to recreate where they came from. But wouldn't it be cool if Florida looked like Florida?
Yeah, people do. They try to recreate what they grew up with in New England or the Midwest down here. It just isn't so easy or kind to the environment to do. So what are some plants we should be planting? Let's reduce our lawn size and then in the place of the lawn, plant some other stuff. What should we be planting?
Well, let's support the wildlife. So we would like butterfly gardens. And if you have insects, then you'll also have birds. So we would end up supporting the wildlife by putting ecosystem plants in there. And just for our information, here in Jacksonville, we're going to have a plant sale, a native plant sale at UNF on Saturday.
This Saturday.
This Saturday at UNF, it starts at 10 o'clock at the Student Union Building. And so I'm also doing a workshop. The workshop is sold out on how to...
Oh, you're popular.
How to nativize your yard.
But people can still come and pick up some native plants.
Still pick up some plants.
Okay.
And tonight I'll be talking at the Murray Hill Library about native plants. So I will be, since the workshop sold out, you can still come in
and see you there.
And see me there. And so I'll be talking about native plants.
What are some native plants we can buy? What do you recommend?
Well, it depends on the size of your yard, of course. But I love the beauty berry. It's so easy to grow. It has unbelievably vibrant purple berries that the birds eat. And actually, you can eat those berries as well. Also, I would recommend... high bush blueberries. I'd recommend nice ground covers like dune sunflower and sunshine mimosa, and all of these really cool Florida natives that we can put in our yard. And one thing about Florida natives is that in Florida we have our wet season, which is now during hurricane season, but then we have a dry season. So our native plants know how to handle that. Mm-hmm. And the plants that you find in a lot of garden shops are annuals that are in full bloom. And as far as the plants are concerned, they're finished. And so when you buy those pretty on the shelf plants and you put them in your yard, they're going to die because the plant says, okay, I've germinated, I've grown, I've bloomed, I've created seeds, and my life cycle is over.
Now, on your blog, Green Gardening Matters, you write that doing a Florida-friendly yard is, in fact, possible in a deed-restricted HOA community.
Yes.
That's something a lot of Floridians say that they run into trouble with. Their homeowners association squawks and complains when they try to change their yard more into the type of yard you recommend. What should people do if they want to have less lawn, they want native plants, but the HOA says no?
Well, there is a Florida-friendly law that was passed, I think, in 2009. But and the law says that no institution and no people can tell you not to have a Florida-friendly yard, but it has no teeth. So one thing we need to do is to have the homeowners associations obey the Florida-friendly law. And so we need to run for the boards of our HOAs so that we get a no grassroots movement, so that the lawn is not the king in the homeowners associations. But there are things that you can do in a native yard that would make it neater, so that if you have a wildflower meadow, that you'd put a neat border around it so it looks like you did it on purpose and it doesn't look like a pile of weeds. So there are a lot of ways to make it work. And that article that I wrote about the homeowners associations was in the Villages, which is a very strict homeowners association.
That's probably the most lawn-loving community America.
But the Native Plant Society, that the chapter there in the Villages is one of the largest in the state.
Interesting.
And they have many of those little tiny lots that are totally native. And they have things like fog fruit and the sunshine mimosa and other things instead of lawn. And then they have hollies, yaupon hollies, and other kinds of native plants in the back and stuff, so that it's really very interesting.
And we're talking with author and landscaper Ginny Steibolt about getting a sustainable yard, one way to mitigate against the impacts of climate change that anybody can do. Ginny says sustainable landscapes have a light impact on the environment. They save you time and money. They reduce carbon dioxide and increase oxygen. They offset the heat that's absorbed by buildings and roads. They increase the wildlife habitat, including birds, bees, butterflies. And they even help you prepare for disasters like hurricanes, fires, and drought.
Yeah.
How do they do that?
Well, when your previous guest talked about planting trees. But when you plant trees, you should plant a grouping of trees, a grove with several trees in a row and shrubs, so that they would be more wind tolerant. A tree planted by itself is much more vulnerable than a group of trees.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you do cool, when you plant a tree, you do cool the air in your yard, because of the way the trees release the water into the air, that actually cools the air. So it's climate-wise, not only because it stores carbon, but it actually cools the air.
Let's go to Mark in Mandarin. He's in the phone queue. Hi, Mark. Hi, Mark. You're on the air. Go ahead, Mark.
Hi. Given quantity of methane gas is much worse for climate change than carbon dioxide, one thing we could do is, like my wife and I, stop buying any beef products. We don't eat anything from mammals because they produce a lot of methane through flatulence. We could even have a tax on cattle used for beef eating. If we eat plants instead of animals.
Sure, just a more plant-based diet. Sure, Mark. Yeah, thanks for that. And certainly millions of people are doing that, or if they're not fully vegetarian, they're moving toward a more flexitarian diet.
Yes.
But in the meantime, Ginny, let's mention again quickly, you will be speaking tonight at the Murray Hill Library about climate-wise landscaping and talking about your book.
Specifically native plants.
Specifically native plants. So you can learn from Ginny tonight. What time at Murray Hill Library?
I think it's 7.
7 o'clock. And then Saturday at UNF, come on out at 10 a.m. for a native plant sale at the UNF Student Union Center right there. That's the Herbert Center. So I'm sure you'll have some takers. People really want to get their hands on these native plants. So
right. We have two native plant vendors, so it's a multi-vendor sale. And there should be plenty there for everyone.
And go to Ginny's website, greengardeningmatters.com. The book is Climate-Wise Landscaping, Practical Actions for a Sustainable Future. Co-author Ginny Steibolt, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks. Thanks, Melissa.
And we'll be right back.
Jacksonville Center for Clinical Research and WJCT present Diabetes, Myths and Facts, an informative lunch and learn seminar, Friday, October 5th at WJCT Studios. Registration at WJCT.org. CNS Healthcare is offering an Alzheimer's research study focused on management of agitation and aggression. Has Alzheimer's changed your loved one? Have they become verbally or physically abusive? Learn more at 904-281-5757.
WJCT's Fall Membership Drive is on right now, but this is not business as usual. We only have a few more days to reach our $60,000 goal. Donate today and support public media the way you like it, quickly, quietly, and without program interruptions. Help us minimize our on-air pledge drives. Make your gift count today. Whether you're renewing your support or making a donation for the very first time, do it at wjct.org/radio. Thanks.
Seeking normalcy after serving time.
Housing, adopting a child, coaching a little league. You know, there's just a gamut of life options that the rest of us would consider totally normal that aren't open to them.
California pushes to clear convictions and create opportunities for the formerly incarcerated. That's next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Weekdays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
For a long time, our food wasn't just dirty, it was dangerous. Milk contained formaldehyde. Well, nowadays, dozens of agencies protect our food supply, but only after a David and Goliath battle led by a pioneering chemist and a determined muckraking reporter. Writer Deborah Bloom on the heroes who made our food safe. That's next time on 1A.
Today at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Well, a quick programming note. Come on out this Friday and join us at WJCT's first ever block party in Five Points. We are saying goodbye to summer and hello to fall in one of the city's most vibrant neighborhoods. Things will kick off at 9 a.m. with a live broadcast of this show at Derby on Park. We'll have breakfast with lots of friends and listeners, and then the party continues all through the day in Five Points, with our music director, David Luckin, spinning right there in the neighborhood and into the night with a live broadcast of Electro Lounge, live from Five Points. Now, this big party is a free block party. Everyone is welcome. But there is a special VIP reception where you can be part of our live First Coast Connect broadcast in person at 9 a.m. at Derby on Park. Get your tickets now at wjct.org/events for that. And special thanks to our lead sponsors, Bread and Board and Derby on Park. So come by Five Points this Friday for our block party. Say goodbye to summer, hello to fall, and support public radio on the First Coast. We'll see you there. Well, finally, this hour, for 20 years now, the Sulzbacher Center in downtown Jacksonville has been working to transform lives and help homeless people in this area get back on their feet again. They're celebrating their 20th anniversary in October with one of the biggest philanthropic events of the year, Transformations. CEO Cindy Funkhauser is here now with more about housing, healthcare, and hope at Sulzbacher. Hey, Cindy, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
And congratulations.
Thank you.
20 years of Sulzbacher, that's quite a milestone.
Yes, it's actually 20 years of the event.
Oh.
Sulzbacher's been around 23 years, so this is our 20th Transformations event.
This is such an amazing event because people that come out to this hear stories of actual living real people mm-hmm. whose lives have been transformed by your efforts. And that will continue this year.
Yes. And this year, it's very exciting. As you know, we opened the Village a few months ago.
And the Sulzbacher Village is a new center for women and children.
Yes. And it's actually 70 units of permanent housing, along with many other things, a huge pediatric clinic, an early learning center, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So the stories this year, the three stories, they revolve around, as you said, housing, healthcare, and hope. That's our new tagline, housing, healthcare, hope. So one of the stories will be about a single mom and her 11-year-old daughter who were living in a car and now live in a beautiful apartment in the Village. The second one will be around a mom who got help through our new pediatric clinic. And then the third, the hope story, is about a family whose child is now in our early learning center that has the trauma-informed overlay. So very, very moving stories.
And what I've learned in talking to you over the years is that the majority now of people who are out of a home and are on the streets or are living in a car, more often than not, it's a woman and children.
Yes.
And so you're meeting a critical need in housing these families and giving them the leg up they need to get back and going again in the workforce, get their kids sheltered and educated. There are thousands of families out there that need this assistance.
Absolutely. And Duval County School System alone has over 3,100 homeless children. So families with children as you said, fastest growing segment of the homeless population. So the Village not only is permanent housing, which is the answer to homelessness, as we know, but it's all the wraparound services that a family would need in order to really become self-sufficient and self-sustaining.
Now, Transformations is coming up October 4th, first week of October, next Thursday night.
Correct.
And people can still get their tickets at sulzbacher.org. And you even are issuing a challenge, I believe.
Yes. We have two of our wonderful donors who are putting up a $50,000 match challenge this week. So we want to thank Susan Gentry Deering and Mary and Richard Ashley for putting that challenge out there. So every dollar that you donate to Transformations this week will get doubled.
Wow.
And you can go on our website, sulzbacherjax.org. And I do also want to say we have great honorary chairs this year. It's Tony Crawford and Dolores Barr Weaver and an amazing MC, Melissa Ross.
I'm looking forward to it. yes. It's been a while since I've attended this event, and I'm excited to be back and part of it. So go to sulzbacherjax.org. Get your tickets to Transformations. Donate. If you donate, as Cindy said right now, your dollar will be doubled. So take advantage of that and help people in this area move into transformed lives. Cindy Funkhauser is CEO of Sulzbacher, and I'll see you next week.
Thanks, Melissa.
All right, that's our show today. Thanks so much for listening, and thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Merchart. Michelle Corum runs the board. Our theme, composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. 1A is up next. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is 89.9. Thanks for listening. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow. And if you missed anything from today's show, just catch our rebroadcast tonight. Next week, catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock. We're continuing for the rest of this week with a special show, America on the Line. Our rebroadcast will be back next week. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.